Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my brethren. I just like the sound of it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Ethel, baby mammy. Fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989, Dancing with the Devil in the Pale Moonlight here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenan Ivar.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us back again is the best creator podcaster podcast? In the biz. I think I called her that last time. I called her the best pie, and she was like, "No." I'm like, "Yeah." This is objective. Karina Longworth, really
dubious achievements, but thank you.
Yes. We are also trying in the podcast game, and we're not the best of all time. Sadly,
no, we're certainly not.
Yes,
but I'm super excited to talk to you about this movie, Karina. I reached out to you, a few weeks ago, and I was just like, who's the person I want to hear talk about Batman the most? And truly, just because it's sort of outside your lane in terms of what you do on your podcast. And I'm just super curious, like, did you see this film when you were a kid, like around 89? Did you see it in the theater? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I saw it in 1989 at the Cineplex Odeon at City Walk, and then I have never seen it since until last week.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now I'm even more excited. I guess the big question here is, what are your thoughts on comic book movies? Like, is this something you watch? Is it a genre that you have any interest in?
Not anymore, no. And, you know, back in 1989, I went to see this movie because of peer pressure. Was definitely like the thing you had to do as a human being. It was a requirement, but certainly it was a requirement in elementary school to have seen Batman. For a long time, it was kind of a case-by-case basis as to whether or not I would be interested in a comic book or superhero movie based on the cast or who was making it or, you know, whatever. Any calculus you make about any other movie, because I was not a comic book reader. And so I didn't have sort of preconceived interest or pre-existing interest. And then the Marvel movies just really broke me. And so I haven't gone to see any of them or seen any of them since Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
Totally fair.
Gotta see a Shane Black movie. I understand that. But until he makes another one, yes. Stay out of the Cineplex. So I felt the same way Phil did. I thought you were a really perfect guest, because what I think is most you know, kind of important what you could bring to this that we don't get from a lot of people is the context and what, where, how you see this film land in the trajectory of films from literally the beginning of time, because this does have some, this does have some spiritual, well, films from the beginning of time and then storytelling for the beginning of time. This is American mythology, right? So you have that on one hand, you have sharing a lot of DNA with, you know, the James Whale, Frankenstein movies and things like that going back to the beginning of cinema. You have, you know, to me, Tim Burton basically, you know, building a German expressionist city that reminds me of, you know,
Fritz Lang. Yeah.
Fritz Lang. Exactly. And that's interesting too. And I wonder how you view that, you know, as a more, honestly, more as a piece of film than as a, you know, a comic book movie or a blockbuster or a studio film or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed watching it, you know, last week. And I probably enjoyed it more because I didn't have really strong memories of the first time I saw it 40 years ago. I guess it wasn't quite 40, but pretty close. I mean, all this stuff you're saying in terms of his references to German expressionism are really fascinating. For me, if I can place it within a trajectory that you didn't mention, it's just Jack Nicholson's career.
Pre-Joker and post-Joker. It's sort of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if it's like a coincidence that you emailed me on the day that you did about this, but the day that you emailed me, I was posting on Twitter about, you know, these magazines that I buy on eBay, which is how I actually do a lot of my research now because archives are still closed. And so I posted about this issue of GQ from, I think, 1981 that had Jack Nicholson on the cover, like in a mustache, like too much of a tan. And it's like, it's definitely
objective.
Like, that is sort of this in-between period between, you know, sort of Chinatown, Jack Nicholson and Batman, where I'm like, I was specifically interested in him in Bob Reifert's remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice, which is something that I'm researching right now. But yeah, definitely, I think that Batman is kind of this new avenue of his career. And unfortunately, I'm not that interested in the stuff he did after, but I think that the performance in Batman is just kind of an all-timer.
I'm also curious about kind of, I mean, ultimately what it did to cinema, right? I mean, it does feel like, I mean, this movie was so colossally successful. It really began the potential of comic book movies being, you know, made in a certain way. But I also, I couldn't help but feel this way as I was watching it the other day. This movie almost feels like an A24 movie in comparison to the comic book movies that we have today. I mean, this was a $35 million budget. It's basically all sets or miniatures. It's map backgrounds, map painting backgrounds. Like it's a beautiful, tactile, old school movie. I mean, you could say the same about Batman Returns as well, which comes out a few years later, but still, like, you don't see this anywhere anymore. Like, this is not even, it doesn't even feel like a comic book movie anymore in a weird way.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's great. To me, the thing that's the least interesting about Batman is Batman. You know, and also the movie seems to think so as well. The movie's not that interested in bat mythology or even any gadgets or anything beyond the Batmobile. And in that sense, it's only interested in it practically. It's only interested in as a function of the story. So it works great for me because I feel like one of the problems with Marvel movies and a lot of contemporary cinema is that they just get so bogged down in fan service and in questions of, like, should we be appealing to the people who know more about this mythology than the filmmakers could ever know, or should we be trying to, defy their expectations?
That's a real damned if you don't situation, you know?
100%. It's you know, it's so interesting how this isn't really an origin story, right? Like, we have a flashback, which I would argue is the best execution. It's not an origin story at all, really. No. It's backfilled about an hour 20 into the film as to sort of how these two men's, you know, lives crossed and how the Joker was the person who killed his parents and all that, you know. But ultimately, the screenwriters aren't interested in doing an origin story, and you couldn't get away with that.
I think,
you know, years later.
I think it's incredibly interesting, Phil. And as I texted you as I was watching, I see this movie a dozen times.
Sure.
But I saw it in the theater when it came out. It was one of the first big movies I ever saw in the theater. Not because I was a Batman fan, probably more because of kind of what you were saying, Karina. I remember distinctly being at camp and having kids walking around playing the Prince
soundtrack.
The Prince soundtrack on little, like, you know, Casio recorders, like the one Joker henchman holding it around. He carries the boombox even when he's not playing music. I love that guy. Yeah. But I remember going to see that film in 89 and loving it and being kind of blown away by how much I loved it in the moment. But what I said to Phil last night is I watched with my son for the first time. I've never let him watch a Batman movie because, you know, the Nolan ones I think are inappropriate. And I think this one is pretty inappropriate up to a point. Yeah, I always remember, dark. You know, Nicholson just shooting holes into Jack Palance and thinking that might be something we should hold off on. So long story short.
Yeah.
I didn't remember how this movie started. And this movie starts with something akin to the Batman origin story, but it's a misdirect. And that was incredibly interesting to me, that it assumed a certain level of Batman mythology understanding on the part of an audience that hasn't had a real Batman property in 20 years. Yeah. You know, a filmed Batman property in 20 years, and comics were at their nadir at this point. So I thought that was really interesting. Now, it plays really well in 2022. Where my son does have a basic understanding of how Batman started and was totally caught off guard by what was going on and had to catch up. I loved that. I loved watching his kind of wheels turn. But yeah, I think there were so many moments in this movie that didn't play like fan service, that just played like respecting the audience in a way I never would have expected.
I was just going to say it's respectful in the sense that they just believe the audience isn't an idiot. I mean, I remember, you know, I'm sure we all remember sort of the various kind of false starts in the whole Spider-Man franchise for many years. They were trying to get that off the ground, and Sony being just adamant that it had to be an origin story, and many filmmakers just passing on the project because they just weren't interested in doing that. I just think it's fascinating that this film in 89, before any of this stuff happens, has so much more courage of its convictions and faith in the audience. It's pretty incredible. I also want to speak, and I'm curious, Karina, obviously, as to your feelings on sort of the tone of this film. And to get to that, I'm curious as to what your feelings are about Tim Burton as a filmmaker in terms of, I mean, he's made a lot of movies, some good, some bad. But I'm curious as to sort of your feelings about him and the tone that he captures with this film.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My feelings about Tim Burton are that it's another situation where I've kind of been off the bus for a while.
Sure.
That was definitely a bus I was on in the 90s, like basically from Batman Returns through maybe Mars Attacks or Sleepy Hollow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think he lost me with Planet of the Apes, but.
I think you lost a lot of people with Planet of the Apes.
And then I really tried with.
I love that movie.
With what is it? The
Sweeney
musical.
Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, I tried. You know, and I actually interviewed him for Alice in Wonderland, which I think is a piece of garbage. And it was like, it was one of these things where it was like, they show you the movie on like a Friday night and the screening ends at like 11 p.m. and you have to be at the junket at 8 a.m. on Saturday. Oh. Wait until it's your turn. And so by the time they got around to me, it was like 2:30 in the afternoon. And they're like, now you can't have half an hour. You can only have 10 minutes. And so I was alone with him in a hotel room for 10 minutes, and it was really strange. And like, I don't know what he does to sustain himself through a long day of press, but it didn't feel like a natural high that he was on. And
interesting.
And so that's my
breaking news
personal experience. So I have not really paid attention to his career since then. But
when you were in the pocket,
I'm thinking about your moment in that hotel. I assume some hotel suite that they rented for him, and you have 10 minutes, so you have to cut your list down by 2/3. And I mean, the first question I would, My question one question. Like, are you okay?
I'm fine. Yeah, it wasn't traumatic. It was just like...
No. My question for Tim would be, are you okay? Everything okay, Tim?
I always had like a little banter going into those situations because I'm like, I don't even think I'm a natural interviewer. And it's always awkward anyway. And so I would always be like, bet you're doing a lot of these today or like something inane like that. But I didn't even have time to ask that. So I said something about how I think he was perceived as, you know, sort of a goth filmmaker. And so it'd be interesting that he would do Alice in Wonderland. And he didn't let me finish the sentence. And
cool. Just
went off on, you know, told me what he wanted me to hear.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a lot of people that are still big Tim Burton fans. I liked Dumbo fine. But people who are
excited about the new Tim Burton release is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Sure. It's been a while since he's made anything. Fans,
but you know, from the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I mean, I think Ed Wood is a masterpiece.
Yes.
Edward Scissorhands. Mm-hmm. I think those would be like kind of the two big ones for me. I enjoyed Mars Attacks as well when I saw them in the theater, mm-hmm. but it's not something I revisited. Same with Sleepy Hollow.
I think it's interesting that like this film obviously, you know, lets him do whatever he wants, right? From this point on, he basically can kind of do whatever he wants. And he essentially gets to kind of make the movies that he wants to make. I'm sure it might be a little tougher in the current IP obsessed world that we're in, but still, and yet he doesn't really love this movie. Like when he's asked about it, it's grown on him. But I think that the process, and we'll get into sort of the way they made this film, which for all intents and purposes feels pretty insane, all things considered, and that it turned into a great movie is kind of a miracle in its own way. But I think the process sucked. I think he had so much studio interference. I mean, he had just come off of Beetlejuice, which was this weirdo little movie where he was kind of let to do whatever he wants. And then all of a sudden he was in a box thinking about McDonald's Happy Meals and trailers and shit that I'm sure he just didn't care about. But you don't see it on the screen. So I guess that's something.
Yeah. I mean, the whole vibe of the movie is almost as punk rock as a movie that is a commercial behemoth could be.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a magic trick. Like, mm-hmm. you know, because the movie is not avant-garde. But it's giving you avant-garde.
Yeah. Do you think that's Nicholson? You were talking about Nicholson, but like Nicholson signing on to this thing really makes it stratospheric, right? I mean, that is at that moment, it feels like he gives I'm sort of curious history-wise, right? He's at his most powerful, would you say, at that point in his career?
I don't know, because the 80s weren't exactly a great decade for him, you know? He made some really interesting movies, but commercially, I think this gave him kind of a new boost of power. So in a weird sense, it was kind of a comeback for him in terms of being like at the center of the culture again.
Sure.
You know, I think the stuff with Nicholson is the best stuff in the movie, but it doesn't all have to do with him. I mean, the design and the conception of this, like one of the products you use to make you more beautiful or attractive or cleaner is going to destroy you and you don't know which one. I mean, that is such an insidious, brilliant idea about capitalism and consumerism.
Plus,
and
coming from that particular character, it really just plays so well.
Yeah. And just the imagery that they, you know, dramatize that idea with is incredible. And it's impossible. I can't imagine a movie going that far today that is intending to reach children as well as adults.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. And like, I'm not someone who tries to traumatize children or someone who's excited about traumatizing children, but it's amazing. Because I was 7 when I saw this movie. I don't think I felt particularly traumatized what I saw, but I actually think the images in this movie, particularly the ones that always stuck with me, were the cutouts of the models with the mouths, you know, the Love That Joker stuff. That stuff always stuck with me. That is more nightmare fuel than anything in The Dark Knight. Yep. By a pretty large margin, I think. And I think that's very, it's tactile, and it really, really truly feels like a threat to all of us in a way that I don't think any superhero movie has nailed. No. You know, I think they tried this a little bit with Batman Forever. The idea that the Riddler was, you know, tapping into television. All of us through our television. And it could be any of us watching and he would essentially steal our brainwaves. But that movie's not on this level for many reasons. And that villain plot is not quite the same. But this is a perfect plot for the villain.
I was thinking about the scene in the museum.
Love it.
When the Joker sits Vicky Vale down and says, I want to be the first homicidal artist. And his whole plan there is terrifying when you think about it. I mean, the mutilation that he, you know, essentially wants to, it seems like he just wants to mutilate women, which is its own thing. But it's just this very sort of a weird sort of perversion of art and aesthetics. And it is quite creepy. It's quite upsetting. There's a lot of stuff in this movie this time round that I found, I don't know why, but the Joker, when he's dressed up like the mime, really kind of freaked me out. I don't know why, but like his little red lips and like that, it's, and the top hat, and there's just stuff that's very, you said it kind of perfectly, very punk rock, but also very kind of unsettling.
Very punk rock.
I think for me that like the thing that felt unsettling comparative to the mime is when he's like taking off his regular person makeup and the white makeup is underneath.
Yes. Yeah.
It's great. Brilliant. It's like
when she throws the water in his face and he's like, I'm melting, I'm melting. Well, it's great.
The quote unquote regular person makeup is something I didn't get for years and years and years. But, you know, now watching just how artificial that makeup looks on his face is, it's so subtle, but it's so good and clever. Yeah. I do want to go back to Nicholson for a second.
Yeah.
Because I think that Nicholson needed this movie more than the movie needed him, even. If you look at his 80s, and I think Karina was saying this more or less, like he won an Academy Award early in the 80s for a supporting role. Not that he was a supporting actor, but he was certainly someone who was willing to take a back seat. Mm-hmm. He was in a few movies that are, you know, Ironweed and Heartburn and Witches of Eastwick, like movies that have persevered to some extent, but really haven't, you know, really aren't the movie you think of when you think of Jack Nicholson. This performance, you know, kind of supercharged him for the rest of his career. And I would say the peak of his power, the 70s, of course, but that resurgence of the 90s with As Good As It Gets and all the movies that came off of that, he was in his mid 60s, one of the three or four biggest stars in the world.
For sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
I also just think it's interesting to sort of, to look at kind of the icon that he was at that time. I mean, the demands that he made to make this film are insane and pretty much unheard of. In terms of, I mean, monetarily speaking, he had enough back end to essentially make $100 million off of this film because of merchandising.
That's good
and
money.
Great. I mean, you would never be able to get it today, but he was able to get it then. But even just like he had an off the clock agreement, his contract basically specified the number of hours he was going to work each day. He would show up at work at like 10 a.m. and just on a bender, basically having had going to parties. He also
I
in
think
his
that's
contract
the last 30 years.
He also said in his contract, he had to be off whenever the Lakers had home games. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you just obviously these are things you could never ask for today, but I kind of feel like, I mean, there were a lot of people up for this role. It's worth talking about just for a quick second. The people that were tossed around at the time that auditioned: Tim Curry, David Bowie, John Lithgow, Ray Liotta, James Woods. Apparently, Robin Williams was offered
James
the
Woods
role.
James Woods would have been terrifying.
Terrifying. Terrifying for a myriad of reasons. But, you know, Robin Williams is offered the role. He's used as a stalking horse to get Nicholson in. And then Robin Williams was pissed off with Warner Brothers for years for having manipulated the situation. But, like, none of them are going to be as good as Nicholson.
Can you imagine what? I think a lot of them would have been really great. I think you just named a lot of people that I would have loved to. Like,
I'm not saying it would have been bad. It's just different.
Like, Tim Curry doesn't, you know, get people excited the way Jack Nicholson does, but you know he would just murder it. Could you imagine Robin Williams? How that would have changed his career?
Sure. Would have changed the movie too, though, because like Robin Williams.
I think it would have been much worse, of course.
For sure. I mean, Robin Williams
he plays villain pretty well. He plays villain pretty well. He wouldn't do that for another 10 years. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Until like Insomnia.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about. I mean, so I don't know, Karina, if you ever heard who Tim Burton wanted to play Beetlejuice in Beetlejuice, but he wanted Sammy Davis Jr. Wow. And it's just, which is insane, but it's also just like, that's where you see some of his casting choices for this film in terms of he didn't want stars in this movie. Michael Keaton was essentially a buddy off of Beetlejuice, and it sort of made sense. And, you know, Warner Brothers, you know, notoriously had like 30,000 letters mailed to them, people saying that they didn't want him to play the role and all sorts of craziness like that. But I just feel like, Tim Burton, for all intents and purposes, does feel like some weird outlier that snuck in to Hollywood.
The two other times I feel like fans revolted against casting choices were Keith Ledger and Daniel Craig in as Bond. Yeah. Only like the two, including, you know, Keaton, but like only like two of the literal best casting choices of all time.
Yep.
The fans are morons.
They are. It's also, I just, in terms of the development of the film, just to sort of a little bit of context, I think it's interesting to talk about how, I guess, Spielberg thought about doing it for a heartbeat, apparently. He wanted Harrison Ford and Michael J. Fox and a whole litany of people. I'm glad we didn't get that film. I love Spielberg, but it doesn't really make much sense. The Coen brothers were offered this movie. They turned it down. I don't know what a Coen brothers Batman looks like, but Cronenberg was offered it. Again, like these are filmmakers that don't make any sense for this property, as much as I adore their work. It is just really interesting to see how they saw this as an auteur vehicle in 89. Like they really did. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I can't explain that.
Neither can I.
Yeah. Why? So let's play the revisionist history game.
Yeah.
Who's the obvious choice? I don't mean to talk ill the dead. He did a great job, but who's the Richard Donner?
That's the thing. I think that, I mean, so you have.
I'm not pitching Richard Donner. I'm just saying, but Superman to me.
Yeah.
Fantastic studio film, more or less what I would have expected a Superman film to look like. Donner got the job done. Who would have been that person in 89 that you go to and Ron Howard?
They did. First of all, they did go to Donner. I mean, because this was produced by Goober and Peters. These are two guys who were obviously two of the biggest producers on Warner Brothers lot. It made sense. They wanted to build this film in the mold of Superman. They wanted John Williams to do the score. They wanted, I mean, I really do think that they thought that was the way to go. Someone, I don't know who, must have been like, have you read the comics? it's super dark and it's about a vigilante and it's about an orphan. And it's like, it's Superman is the all-American and it makes total sense to do what they did with Superman. But these are very different pieces of IP. So when that pivot happens, you got to look down that list and be like, they went to Joe Dante, which makes sense. Like they went to these people that were sort of existing in a world where they were somehow making accessible dark movies.
The other thing that's kind of amazing, you know, is the predominant iconography behind Batman at the time, at least in, you know, the public sphere, was the 60s television show, which was very campy and over the top and very funny. It was essentially a comedy and relied on, you know, cameos and puns and all that stuff. And Batman, you know, that's what all, you know, the executives probably grew up with, including Burton, actually. I would have expected executives to default to that kind of Batman.
For sure.
And what I think happened was, you quote unquote, did you read the comics? I'm pretty sure the did you read the graphic novels is the real question, right? Yeah. Did you read the Frank Miller stuff? Yeah. Did you read The Killing Joke? Did you read, you know, Year One? Did you read The Dark Knight Rises? These things are, I believe those are the things that did eventually convince the studio this might work.
Yeah. Karina, I'm curious, and this is kind of a slightly 30,000 feet perspective, but I'm curious, I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the Jokerified world that we live in right now a little bit, and how, you know, we've seen so many versions of this character and I guess my question is more, why do you think this character has its hooks in America in the way that it does. Because it is, as we've said, a super dark, nihilistic, twisted thing that we've now had how many versions of? Five or six, I think, at this point. I'm not sure how many. But
we've had, we've had seven live actions. Okay. We had Batman versus Superman. We had Justice League. So those are two more. And we've had... We were actually eight, including the Adam West. So that's 10 total. And then
animated ones, sure.
Mask of the Phantasm. Yeah. So those are the 11 that have actually come out in theaters.
Do you have thoughts, Karina, as to why the Joker, why America loves the Joker?
I mean, Batman. I was speaking of the Joker,
but it doesn't matter.
Five different Jokers, six, including Cesar Romero.
You know, I mean, I haven't seen most of those movies, but so it's hard for me to say like what America is responding to. You know, I got the sense, like, I didn't see the Joaquin Phoenix Joker.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I got the sense when that movie was out that people were responding to it in this sort of, like, red state America way. But, I mean, not necessarily, like, everybody who went to see that movie and liked it was a Trump voter, but that it just, it kind of appealed to something that's going on in the world about masculinity and it sort of not, it's discontents, you know, for lack of a better term. But... I mean, for me, I think what I have a better insight into is just that actors love it, and they love it for a number of reasons. You know, it's a chameleonic part. It lets them sort of explore both darkness and hope in a way. So that makes more sense to me than why people want to buy it.
Yeah, Kenny and I, we did a whole episode on the Joker trailer. so we certainly were curious about it. And I do think that I absolutely agree with you on an acting perspective. I think that, I mean, notoriously, Nicholson spoke to Heath Ledger before he started the role and was like, listen, this thing can be kind of intoxicating and it can kind of get in your blood a little bit. And obviously we know how that transpired for Heath. But I do think that it's dangerous in a way that feels playful. You know, it has this kind of this nihilism that exists underneath it all. But it fascinates me. I'm just, of all the roles, it's interesting that this is the one that people seem to love so much.
It's interesting to me because you watch Batman, the movie we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my son about it this morning because he's a nerd. And he's not a nerd. He's a wonderful guy. But he loves talking about this shit. And and we were talking about how this is more of a Joker movie than a Batman movie, right? The origin story you get is the Joker's origin story. And the emotional arc you have is Joker's emotional arc. And you're with Joker for every decision he makes.
Yeah.
And there's very little development when it comes to Bruce Wayne and Batman, but there's a lot of development when it comes to the Joker. And this kind of is this less so than the Joaquin Phoenix movie, but you know, I think they kind of play in the same area. This is kind of the exception to the rule of my omnipresent argument that you can't make movies about villains, which is like I do think there is this desire among actors to play wonderful, rich, funny, scary villains, and I have always thought a lot of that is because the stakes are so low. The stakes are so low because you don't have to have anybody buy in. You don't have to have anybody be on your side. There is no empathy that you are trying to pull from the audience. So it's like as I've always said, the hardest thing to do as an actor is off the table for you. Go have fun. But to put that character at the center of your movie and ask the audience to follow this person throughout, and at least like with the Joker in particular and Jack, like you are supposed to feel him. You are supposed to feel him be wounded by Jack Palance in the beginning. And you are supposed to feel him outdone by the Batman at all these turns. And it is a bit of a unusual position for the audience to be in. I think that's probably really exciting for an actor to toy with an audience in a way that you almost never can.
And frankly
never should, because it's such a high wire act.
Well, there's such a theatricality to it that I think it must be a lot of fun. But this also speaks a little bit to sort of, and Karina, you can speak to this probably far better than I can, but like this movie has a timeless component to it it feels like it doesn't exist in a specific time. You have sort of these detectives and these newspaper people that almost exist in the 30s. And then you've got like this femme fatale almost in Vicky Vale, but also sort of a damsel in distress, but also this reporter. Like there's just kind of a lot going on there. There's
it like feels film like a noir-ish. Very 80s woman to me, like a very 80s movie woman, like, you know, that like this very complicated 80s, like sort of post-feminist, but like we're not actually going to call it feminist depiction of a career woman. So, yeah. But I mean, yeah, I would agree with you that it's this hybrid of like a 1930s newspaper movie, German expressionist production design, 80s sort of pop music and like early rap influence as well, sort of 80s street culture. You know, I mean, like it, the, all the art stuff and like just Joker with like with his sort of like posse. I mean, it feels like they could be, you know, going to like Limelight. They could be hanging out with Keith Haring. That's one of the things that's so cool about it is that, or is so fun to watch about it is that it does feel like it's coming out of like a real sort of subcultural place. But it's at the highest level of pop mass culture at the same time.
When you list all those things, again, it just kind of amazes me that this movie worked for anybody. Like, it's amazing to me that it hits
for everybody.
Yeah. That's
right. Well, yeah, sure.
I mean, do you think that audiences were just like more excited about going with the flow at that time? Like, were they more culturally savvy?
I mean, this is the last episode of our 89 Patreon, and we've done about 50 some odd films, I think, give or take. You know, the biggest, certainly the most beloved. And it's a very interesting year in terms of, you know, what hit, why it hit, even the Academy Awards, which we've obviously talked about a fair amount as well. But like, that's another thing. I kind of can't believe Jack Nicholson didn't get an Oscar nomination for this. Like, despite the fact that I know it's a comic book movie, but like, it's still Jack Nicholson.
No one
it's
knows
still
to
like,
do. Yeah, what to do with this movie?
But didn't like Pacino get nominated for Dick Tracy? Like,
yes,
he got nominated
the next year.
Yeah. That was the next year. Yeah.
So it's like
but I mean, this movie, you know, ran so Dick Tracy could run.
It's a wall.
Mile per hour. Yeah, no, I love Dick Tracy. Like I
do too.
Dick Tracy's fun, but Dick Tracy's not this. No. So we've done 50 movies, and this isn't the best or my favorite, but this is the boldest movie.
It is.
I would say bolder than the second boldest, which is Sex, Lies, and Videotape. this is the most avant-garde. Yeah. This is the biggest swing. The other movie that made a ton of money this year on this level was Indiana Jones 3, which is like a movie I love and is so down the middle. It's so down the middle compared to this and kind of, you know, it wrought nothing.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Whereas this birthed the next 35 years of Hollywood.
For sure. I mean, just look at the weekend. So this movie comes out June 23rd, 1989. It opens against Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Ghostbusters 2, Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society. All of those movies made a boatload of money. I mean, this is right in the middle of the summer. But still, this is this is maybe the blockbuster year, right? This is the year where the studios look at it and say, okay, so weak franchises are possible, $100 million, you know, opening weekends, all that kind of stuff that seems possible. And yet, I mean, Dead Poets Society made just an insane amount of money for a movie about like a bunch of boys at a prep school. And, you know, it's just a different, I mean, obviously it's a different time, but to your question, Karina, in terms of whether or not if we had better taste back then, or is it just that we were given better options, is kind of hard for me to say.
It's not even better taste. Like, I just kind of wonder if the audience was, there was an assumption. I mean, you said it earlier that the movie doesn't treat the audience like idiots in the way that some of these movies do today. Mm-hmm. I also wonder if there was an assumption that the audience like knew a little bit about music, knew a little bit about art, knew a little bit about film history, knew a little bit about history. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't so crazy to put all these things in the same movie.
You don't, I mean, like, there may have been and there probably was, but I wouldn't even, like, if I were making the film, I wouldn't even take that into account. I would just trust that the audience can catch up. Because sure. I know my 9-year-old knows nothing about this stuff, but I know he was able to catch up and there was something about the stew that felt right to him. So I think, you know, Karina, as you know, we do 99 normally. And not that they're similar in any way, but The Matrix reminds me of this. In that it is a high-minded idea, you know, this is original, you know, Batman isn't, but a high-minded idea done differently doesn't look like any other mock blockbusters or movies made for that amount of money and just became a phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't care if you get it or not.
No. And it trusts that if you're curious, you will do the research after and you will fill in the blanks on your own. But it takes you far enough that the whole thing works, even if you're not willing to do that. And pose it to both of you. What was the last, like, and I'm sure there are dozens of answers, but what was the last big blockbuster that felt this, you know, shot out of a cannon? Because I can't, to me, like the Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, like those are so built in. Those just as visually amazing as Lord of the Rings are, and you know, the scope and the storytelling, that just doesn't feel like what we're talking about. Like,
well, because it feels like what we're talking about here is, and the reason The Matrix is so good and the reason that this is so good is just so many different genres that have been put into a blender. I mean, with The Matrix, you know, kung fu to cyberpunk to all these different things that they're kind of just putting in a stew and saying, like, isn't this cool? And I don't think, I mean, I can't think of filmmakers that are interested in doing that right now. I mean, I guess.
Or able or allowed, you know, like that's just.
Yeah. I mean, I do think Tarantino's doing it, but it's kind of more, I don't know.
It hasn't felt this exciting in a long time. Like, I like a lot of Tarantino's movies, but I really don't think since, you know, maybe Kill Bill has something felt this exciting.
And no, I agree. God love Tarantino, but part of the thing is we know him at this point. Like, part of the thing is I go into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood expecting to kind of be blown away to some extent. And I kind of know his tricks by this
point. Wouldn't you also say that, you know, Karina, you were kind of listing all the stuff that exists in this film, and those are things that are plausibly people would know about. Whereas Tarantino stuff is so obscure. You know, I mean, he loves himself so much and his knowledge of film so much that, you know, it's a litany of such obscurity, and it's cool to watch, but like Batman feels far more pop culture.
Right. But it's like, I mean, he's referencing obscure movies, but in a context that everybody knows about, you know, like everybody knows about slavery, World War II, and the man.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, one filmmaker who is, you know, probably my favorite working filmmaker is Paul Thomas Anderson. And it doesn't look like Licorice Pizza is going to be a blockbuster. You know, of course, I don't know, like, how we even judge success of movies right now. But that's a movie that really did surprise me in a lot of ways. And, you know, I guess I thought I knew quite a bit about it before I saw it. But in terms of, like, his willingness to make a completely episodic film, that feels like something that I haven't seen a filmmaker do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel as though he has definitely, I mean, I don't think there's a filmmaker right now who's just like, every film just feels like another leap forward in terms of what he's trying to do, and a fearlessness that we're sort of speaking of, that courage of your convictions. You know, I went to see Phantom Thread again recently in 70mm at the Arrow, and again was just absolutely blown away by that movie and what he's doing there and all the different influences and all the kind of, that it's, I guess, kind of a dark comedy. I'm not really sure. The movie's doing a lot of stuff. But to your point, it's a rom-com. But to your point on Licorice Pizza, which I do think is a good example of, you know, kind of putting a bunch of things in a stew and hoping that people will play along. I don't know that there's that many filmmakers that are doing that. Were you going to say
I'll
something?
I'll tell you, there's a guy who always kind of, you know, rides side saddle with Paul Thomas Anderson for me. Mm-hmm. And that's Darren Aronofsky, who mm-hmm. at one point was going to do a Batman movie, I believe.
Yeah, year one.
And that didn't work out. But he, to mm-hmm. me, yeah, takes even wilder swings.
Sure.
And I love misses. Mother. I'm like yeah. the biggest mother.
Mother's crazy.
That's kind of what I'm getting at, right? Like,
yeah.
If Paul, like, there is a case to be made that the Paul Thomas Anderson movies from There Will Be Blood, more or less till now, are wild swings that just don't feel like wild swings because they're so tight and competent and they work so well together. Whereas you see the seams in some of Aronofsky stuff, but also, you know, there's nothing like Mother, and there's nothing like The Fountain, and there's nothing like, you know, Black Noah. Swan, or what's that?
Noah.
There's nothing like Noah. He is a wild man. Who, yeah, I know. He's a wild man who I think does have the potential to, like, isn't he doing the movie with Brandon Fraser right now?
The Whale.
The Whale?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that movie. Yeah. But I don't know anything about that movie except, like, something, you know, some crazy shit.
Not to just devolve this podcast into a litany of other filmmakers that do this stuff, but I just want to name one other one. I do think that Guillermo del Toro is another guy who feels like, I mean, I really liked Nightmare Alley quite a bit. It does feel like, I mean, that is a remake of an adaptation. So, like, there's several pieces of IP and what have you. But that movie is playing with all sorts of, you know, sort of supernatural carny universe mixed with film noir, mixed with con artists. Like, it's trying to do a lot of things. Some would argue maybe not as successfully as others, but he is a guy who I feel also has the courage of his convictions in the sense of taking wild swings.
So to kind of close loop on this point, yeah, we're talking about a bunch of filmmakers. Mm-hmm. They are all men and they are all basically the exact same age. And they have all had, art house success and a certain measure of popular success, but not a ton, but mm-hmm. you know, enough.
Yeah.
They've mostly avoided doing superhero movies, though. Del Toro did a couple of Hellboys, mm-hmm. Hellboys, and
two Hellboys.
And I don't disagree that the three guys we mentioned, and you can put in Uritu in that category as well, and there are a few other people who do get to kind of do what they want to do.
Cuarón also, probably.
Yeah, Cuarón. You could put some people in that category, but for the most part, these are established people who Hollywood has decided you get $30 million when you want $30 million. Yeah. What I really hope is that somebody... You don't need $30 million, but somebody could do this on their first film, you know? And you know, really, it's very hard. It's just very hard to do something this visually striking, this tonally consistent, but out of the box and thematically, mm-hmm. you know, unusual and dark and whatever. So
I want to just take a sec to kind of, I mean, we're not going to talk about the plot necessarily, because, you know, it's Batman. You've either seen it, you've probably seen it if you're listening to this episode. But I did text Kenny something Kenny and I were texting about how it takes about 30 minutes for Bruce Wayne to show up in this movie. You know, the opening of this film is really bold in the sense of kind of, you've got that the family mirroring Bruce's parents, you know, and I remember as a kid.
Shocking.
As a 9-year-old thinking, oh, well, that must be Bruce's parents. Like, I remember sitting in the theater and being like, oh, it must be his parents. And then obviously it's a psycho to some degree or another. But like, Batman's entrance is so fucking awesome. And yet it's like walking a razor's edge of being laughable. Like, there's a version of this film that tips and none of this works. And I just, it's kind of a real high wire act of, I mean, he literally says, I'm Batman. And it's awesome,
okay.
But it's also pretty ridiculous.
This is 89. This is the first one through the gate. You could do that.
Sure. But I also love that that was an improv by Michael Keaton. He was actually, the line was actually supposed to be, I am the knight. And,
oh.
And Keaton was like, no. So, I mean, again, these are things where you're just like, it shouldn't work. But those two robbers are great. The two guys on the roof doing the American Express thing, and the, and just it immediately, it's just so confident. You're just, you know, you're in good hands, is kind of what I'm saying.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I'll go. You know, the thing that I kind of think is funny is the hand-to-hand combat in this movie. Now, it raises quite a few rungs in Batman Returns, because the fighting between Batman and Catwoman is pretty incredible and like acrobatic. Uh-huh. But this,
well, he can move in the suit in the second.
He can move in the suit. I know. He's always he has his whole body. But it reminds me a little bit of like of Star Wars, in that in the movies, the original trilogy, the lightsaber battles are so slow. And you're not really even doing anything. There's no flips. There's nothing. And then the movies that are supposed to take place 30 years in the past, you have, you know, you have Yoda bouncing around like a ping pong like the ball. And it's the same thing here. This hand-to-hand combat is so simple. It is it's kicks and it's punches. And it doesn't matter. So much of this is hidden because of the low light. So much of it is hidden because of the black mask.
Editing.
The editing. It's that stuff I know you do to hide your flaws, but it just makes me feel so confident in the storytelling.
For sure.
It didn't feel like everything had to be told.
I mean, I would say that one of the things I think is great about this movie is that it's the opposite of something that's turned me off from a lot of contemporary films, which is like all of the fighting, all of the action in this movie needs to be there. And it's not, it doesn't take up any more screen time than it needs to tell you the story of it. Whereas now it's like, I'll see a movie like Wonder Woman and I'll go to the bathroom 45 minutes before the end thinking like, there's got to be just 5 minutes left. And there isn't.
It is a big problem in terms of tent poles now, which is the amount of money they spend on these set pieces, right? Where it's like they're afraid to cut any of this stuff. So it just feels like you're bogged down, especially in the Marvel films that essentially turn into a video game for your last, you know, as you said, 40 minutes or so, where you're just like, yeah, you know, there's going to be a bunch of spaceships. It's all going to be CG. None of it's ultimately going to matter very much. And to your point, all this intimate fighting, which there isn't a ton of, serves a purpose. It serves a character purpose, or it serves a plot purpose. I mean, I think about the first interaction between, or I guess the only interaction between Jack Napier and Batman, before he goes over the thing into the vat of chemicals, is just sort of, you know, it's more of a detente. You know what I mean? It's more of these two guys that are kind of sizing each other up than it really is an actual physical fight. You also get the impression too that like Batman is trying to save him. He doesn't want to drop him into the chemicals. It's just you know what I mean? There is something to that. All the access chemical stuff, Tim Burton talked about it being just a nightmare to shoot. It was an awful experience shooting inside this factory with all these. It was just awful. But like, this is actually a good opportunity to talk about how muted this movie is, the color palette of this film. And now the punch of color really comes from the Joker and from his suits or from his you know, various cars or henchmen or whatever. But like, it's a very muted film. I would argue that I think Batman Returns is a more colorful movie than this movie is. Now, admitted,
no question,
right? It just feels,
it's a Christmas movie. Just, and I'm not joking. It's there. There's Christmas imagery all over.
Yes,
so you know, you have the black, whites, and grays and silvers of your Gotham, but you also have pops of
tinsel
green,
and
pops of red everywhere. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. So it's interesting how people talk about how Batman Returns is a darker film than this, and maybe psychologically it is in terms of the emotional turmoil the characters are going through. But I actually think that this film, because Nicholson is such a live wire, I think this movie is a lot more quote unquote fun than. Do you sort of see what I'm like? I feel like there's a pop culture-ness to his Joker that was so iconic and so much fun. I mean, half of his lines don't even make any sense. Like, I mean, that line before he kills when he's dressed up as the mime, I have it here. Hello, Vinny, it's your Uncle Bingo. Time to pay the check? What does that even mean? What does that have to do with
everybody
anything?
Knows what that means. I know Karina knows what that means because it was used in the 20s all the time.
Was it? So, I mean, maybe.
Yeah, the first talkies. They were always about Vinny and Uncle Bingo.
Sure.
So,
but it's so crazy how even just like they never rub another man's rhubarb. But there's a part of me that just feels like Nicholson's just talking. Like he's just saying words, and there's like, that's gold. Just keep doing what you're doing.
This is why he thought he can do this in The Departed. Because he was so successful under, you know, face painted in a purple suit.
Sure.
He thought he could also say absurd shit in The Departed.
Crazy shit.
It kind of reminds me of like when Hollywood actors would go do Italian films and they'd, you know, record all the audio later. And so they'd just be like, you know, just act with your face, say something.
Sure. Sure. Like House of Gucci. But it's just, there is something about Nicholson. There's an unhinged playfulness to him that I think transcends the darkness of this movie. Whereas DeVito's gross, horny penguin with oozing shit coming out of his mouth doesn't have the same, you know, fun, I guess, fun factor. I don't know. But it's really.
I mean, Phil, I might be jumping way ahead.
No.
But you and I think we've both stated on this podcast many times that we prefer Returns the second 100%. To the first.
100%.
I'm not going to say that I'm going to...
Oh, no.
I'm not changing it. I do think Batman Returns is the better film because I think the Michelle Pfeiffer, Michael Keaton thing is chemistry unlike I've ever seen in a movie. But it's closer than I thought. Is that what you feel? It's closer than I thought.
I do really like this movie a lot. I love this movie. And you know, when we get to the end, we'll talk about, you know, where it falls for us in terms of ratings. But I do think that my affinity for Batman Returns is just... it just feels like more of a Tim Burton movie. You know, he's clearly been just sort of let off the chain. He's like, I'm going to make a movie about just a bunch of freaks and sadomasochism, I guess. And just a bunch of shit that's one of those movies that feels like a miracle that the studios even let him make it. This movie to me is just, you know, it's very clean. It's very streamlined. You know, you do get sort of a feeling of studio interference in some of the kind of, some of the origin stuff, some of the kind of just easiness of it. They don't want to challenge people that much with this film. I feel like Batman Returns is a more challenging film than this. But I'll also say too, like this film I was watching yesterday and, you know, you've got the Batmobile driving through these gothic woods and you've got this iconic Danny Elfman score. And this movie is definitely weird. Like this movie's not weird, just to be clear. It's super weird.
Jerry Hall with the mask. I mean,
the mask is weird. So Karina, what are your, do you have Kim Basinger thoughts? Like where this is falling in her career and how, you know, all that?
I don't really have thoughts about where this falls in her career. I'm trying to think, it's definitely post The Natural. And obviously, it's about like 5 years before she wins the Oscar for L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, so she wins in 97. So it's almost
it
10 years.
Yeah.
So I think you know, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you guys know she was not the first choice for this part. Sean Young was cast. And I've actually been, for various reasons, reading a lot of Sean Young interviews this week.
Interesting.
And she, you know, she was fired because she broke her arm falling off of a horse in rehearsals. Lately, she has started to say that she thinks that that accident was set up to get her fired from the movie. Because she says that she thinks that John Peter has had such a crush on Kim Basinger. This is starting to sound like, you know, John Peter like hired his goons to push her off a horse. It's hard to imagine.
Seen like Rafita.
The thing is that I think that Sean Young is a more interesting actress. And I do mourn for the Batman that she would have been in. I think that for me, it's not Kim Basinger's fault, but I think that Vicki Vale is the worst character in the movie. The fault of it is in the writing. You know, the one line of this movie that I remembered from 1989 that I still remembered as a 42-year-old woman, like going to watch it again, was he asks her how much she weighs. She says 108. They do the whole thing on the wire. He puts her down and he says, "You're a little bit more than 108." Like that kind of misogyny was so normal in 1989. And it imprinted on me as a 9-year-old in this way where it's like, well, I guess you're not supposed to weigh more than 108 pounds.
Which is insane.
If a woman weighs more than 108 pounds, that's a problem and they should lie about it. That's the way that, and otherwise, you know, she has a couple of nice moments, but I don't buy the romance. It's too fast.
It's very fast.
Mostly I think she's just kind of used as a pawn between these two guys.
Yeah. I mean, I can't disagree with any of that. I think that Kim Basinger is, she's very watchable in the sense that she has a charm and she has this sort of star quality to her that makes makes her a lot of fun to watch in the film. But to your point, I do feel like, first of all, I think someone counted and I think she screams like 50 something times in the movie. I mean, I would say like half of her dialogue is her screaming. But she does have some really nice moments. In particular, the moment when Bruce is trying to tell her that he's Batman, and you do kind of like when the movie slows down for a second and lets her have a moment, she's actually quite good. The movie just doesn't have time or interest to do that very much. You know, that the Sean Young thing is interesting too, because as I'm sure you know in the articles you've read, the whole Catwoman fiasco that transpired from Batman.
That I don't understand. She had their numbers, but I think more into Kim Basinger's performance than perhaps you guys are. And I think I watched this a little. Sorry, I actually remember kind of distinctly as a 7-year-old. Being disappointed in Vicki Vale's character. It's a weird thing to say, but I distinctly remember there was a Prince song about her.
Oh yeah, Vicki Vading.
Yes.
A great song.
Yes. And Prince having the song about her somehow implanted this idea in my 7-year-old mind that this was a big, important character. Right?
Okay.
Like this was going to be a consequential character.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, when is it going to happen? Right? I even remember saying, and this is such a weird thing, but I remember saying to my parents who took me to the movie, like, she's going to get cool. Like, it's how could she not? Prince wouldn't bother writing a song about someone who wasn't cool, and she never got cool. So
the song is from the perspective of Bruce Wayne being like, I can't share. Why can't I share myself with this woman? Like, and is it even worth it to bring children into this world?
It's a crazy song.
To be fair, yeah. The song's really more about Bruce.
I don't think I got that at the time, but I don't think I knew what Darling Nikki was about either. So, you know, like, you never know with Prince. But what I was going to say was, I watched this movie with this weird little, like, protectionist sure. urge over this character, which is like, you're not as bad as they say you are, and you should have been brought back, and all these things. So I do think she did a good job. Particularly, it's interesting you talk about the 50 screams, because I think her reactions are incredible.
They're genuine.
Yeah, I don't think they're really bad. They're really good, and they really, like, Vicki Vale is the one who tells you the story on her face, tells you how to feel in the moment, and how terrified you'd be the Joker, and frankly, sure. how comforted you should be by this man in a bat suit. Right. And then the thing I'll always remember, I remember the first time I saw it was the way she kissed his suit. There was something about
the Joker suit.
When she starts kissing him back to kind of, to lure him into a sense of, I suppose, you know, vulnerability.
But then there's also an illusion of oral sex. Kind of insane. That this movie gets away with.
Kind of insane.
Like, every time I see it, I'm just like, wow, they go there.
I don't think she did a terrible job. And I also think, the reason I think she did kind of a good job is because, you know, the last shot of the movie is Batman on the roof looking at the bat signal, but that's, you know, that's just a poster. The last moment of this movie is Vicky being in the back of Alfred's car and being part of the team now. And that feels
she's going to get cool now.
one would hope.
It's funny because I do think that Vicki Vale as a character, it's sort of interesting that we are where we are now, where every single character is mined for a television show or a spinoff or a whatever, and Vicki hasn't got that treatment yet. I know, admittedly, she's popped up in a couple CW shows or your WB shows, but like Vicki Vale, for good or bad, feels like this is the quintessential version of her. And I'm not sure that that does the character as much service or justice as she perhaps deserves. But it is just interesting, too, that, like, you know, Kim Basinger wins in 97, but kind of is in the wilderness after this for quite some time. So it's interesting that because she turns down Batman Returns, Vicki was going to be in a version of it, and she turns it down, which, you know, more power to her. But she doesn't use this film to kind of catapult a career in the way that perhaps would have been nice, I guess.
Well, we should look at the dates. I think maybe she got pregnant. I think maybe she took a couple of years off to have a kid and be married to Alec
with everyone's favorite actor. It is interesting. I want to talk about the Prince thing for a second, because I do. So the Prince thing was apparently a John Peters idea that Tim Burton was not particularly on board for, which is why the Prince, there's two big Prince song moments. There's the museum and then there's the parade. Other than that, there's some kind of played very low in the background where you can't even really tell that they're there. I'm kind of surprised Tim Burton didn't wrap his arms around the Prince thing a little bit more, because they do feel like two peas in a pod.
I mean,
to me,
I think it's like he already had this relationship with Danny Elfman.
Right.
You know, he probably was hearing Elfman's score throughout the whole thing, ideally. And when, you know, it's a fantastic score. Like,
yeah.
And it's well used, you know. And I actually think that there's exactly enough Prince music in the movie.
Yeah.
Because then it's fun that you get to, like, listen to the whole Prince album and get more of it.
And watch the music videos, which are amazing.
It's, to me, supremely weird that Tim Burton, Prince, and Batman teamed up ever. And it worked a little bit. Like, it's every once in a while you see a movie where you have multiple songs by someone. And whenever you have multiple songs by anybody in a movie, I think that's a little weird. Sometimes it's Amy Mann and Magnolia, and it's the best thing
sometimes
in the world.
Sometimes it's Cat Stevens and Harold and Maude. You know?
Yes, and sometimes, yeah, exactly. Sometimes it works so well, and it's so wonderful. But the instinct to do that thing, it's just, it's a weird thing to me, and particularly in this one, because, like, I don't know. You went, obviously Prince is a wild, wild performer and artist. Sure. And I love him very much, but he's very specific and he was also very famous. And to like tack on someone that specific and that famous mm-hmm. to a film like this was not even bold. I maintain it's crazy.
And well, what's crazier
it didn't,
was,
I can't believe it didn't derail the film.
Well, the original plan, which I don't know if you know, was actually, it was going to be Michael Jackson.
Prince and Michael Jackson, I know.
So Prince was going to be the Joker side of the coin, and Michael Jackson was going to be the Batman side. And I mean, that just seems absolutely insane. I mean, for a whole bunch of reasons. But
it would overshadow the film. It's
all of it. It's crazy.
Bonkers.
And then for the next one, there's one song, and it's by Susie and the Banshees, which actually probably makes more sense for Tim Burton in terms of like the, you know, the goth pop star that she was. So I don't disagree with you, Kenny. There's a part of me that's like, if you lifted the Prince songs out of this, I don't think the film's any worse for it. But the Prince songs are there; they do pop when they happen.
Yeah, I'm not knocking them. I love it. I love it, and I love that it happened, because then you look at the Schumacher films where he just pulled the, you know, the biggest artist in it at the given time and said, write something kind of like Batman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get Stone Cold classics like Kiss from a Rose, which is about heroin.
It's a very romantic song.
It all means nothing, right? Like means nothing at that point, because they really have, you know, kind of they've kind of done that headfirst dive into marketing first and filmmaking second. But again,
I had that soundtrack though. That Batman Forever soundtrack. It's got some bangers on there. That U2 song.
Kill Me.
Flaming Lips.
One of the only U2 songs that holds up for me.
Wow.
I know every word to Kiss from a Rose. I am not knocking the song.
No, I didn't think you were. So I want to talk for a second about the climax of the film. Which revolves around the Joker murdering everyone in Gotham City because they want money, which is fair. But it's
Why he murders them. That's why he's able to murder them.
Correct. Sorry, my apologies. Yes. Their greed allows him to murder them. There's an image that really kind of breezes by, but really hit me hard this time around, which is a man using money to try as a mask to try to stop the gas from getting. And I'm just like, damn, like this is pretty fucking crazy. But yeah, I mean,
how about Alexander Knott just having an N95 in the back of his car?
there is that too. And a baseball bat. That was also a moment where she hits him with the car and knocks him out and she just takes off. We're just like, we need Knox out of the equation. So how do we get rid of him? But all of that, that whole sequence, all the Batwing stuff looks absolutely gorgeous in terms of just the use of the miniatures and the practicals. All of that sort of gothic flying around through the various architecture of Gotham City. But then also just, I mean, an image or a moment that feels like it encapsulates the playfulness of the movie is when the Joker pulls a giant gun out of his pants and just...
That's a good gun.
It's a good gag.
That
blows the Batwing out of the sky.
This is so funny because Batman is in some version of a bat fighter jet and firing
missiles
missiles and he's firing, you know, missiles down at Joker who stands in the middle of the street, come and get me. He misses him. The only time he misses anybody in all the films. Yes. And Joker is able to take down the Batwing with one shot from his extra long gun.
It's fantastic. And the thing is too, is that apparently
also that one of the best things happened like right around that moment too, which is, you know, he just kills Bob. Just out of nowhere, he just like
gun.
He just kills him.
And then he says, "I'm gonna need a moment alone, boys." Yeah, it's
and the Bob is with him when he kills the parents. Bob is his man from way back, and he just had a bad moment.
That's great. That's great. I do think that the gun is great because it almost feels like Dr. Strangelovey and how like sort of satirical and funny it is. But what's also great is that originally it was supposed to be a tank that he was going to drive out from underneath the parade float. Yeah. And I'm just like, I mean, sure, but this is so much better. It's so much silly. Like, it's just silly and great. So then we get to the cathedral. This is sort of the end of the film. And apparently, originally, Vicki Vale was never supposed to go up into the cathedral. It was Kim Basinger's idea. She's like, I think I should be involved in this, which I mean, she wasn't wrong. But
please give me something to do.
Can I please not drop off out of this movie for the last? So they obviously write her into it. But then apparently they had no idea what they were going to do at the top of the cathedral when they shot the bottom of the cathedral. So Tim Burton just said to Jack, like Jack Nicholson turned to him and said, what am I doing when I get to the top? And he's like, we'll figure it out when we get there. I mean, this is just... I don't know, man. How do you make movies like this? How do you just like, it's crazy that it worked.
It is a little underwhelming that this fight kind of happens and Batman wins.
And then
Joker's able to pull them both somehow off the side. Not even because he's stronger, because he's wearing, 3 inches of body armor, but he's able to pull him off the side and they're just kind of hanging there, but he saves it, one with his dancing and two with him looking up at the gargoyle and saying, what are you laughing at? What a line, what a guy.
Also, you wouldn't hit a guy with glasses, would you?
Always remember that.
It's really crazy stuff. I mean not to keep belaboring this, but it really, like, the Joker is saving all of this. Nicholson is saving all of this, right? Because, as you said, Kenny, it's a bunch of sort of, relatively unenthusiastic action because Tim Burton's not a particularly good action director. Michael Keaton can't move in the suit. It's darkly lit, and it's him. He fights a couple guys. He kicks a couple guys, and then he punches the Joker. And, but the Joker's lines of, like, you made me, I made you. I mean, how childish can you get? I mean, that type of stuff saves all of it. On paper, the climax of this film is somewhat, a little snoozy. It doesn't have a ton going on.
Well, they just kind of get to the point where it's like, okay, enough. We got to get rid of the Joker and wrap it up,
Yeah.
Yes. It's like there's nothing sort of satisfying left to do.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
The way he goes down is great. Nicholson's face is great. He's holding on to that rope ladder. Mm-hmm. It's great. Like, it's just...
They kill him, too. Can we just talk about that for a second? Like, they kill
so
the Joker.
Satisfying.
Like, it is.
The whole thing, the whole end, everything about it is just so satisfying. And then the ultimate score into the...
They just never kill villains anymore, first of all. Most of the time they keep them alive for to come back in future films.
You also don't want your hero, unless he's Deadpool, to actually kill people. But Batman was kind of okay with it.
Batman was more than okay.
I mean, that's like the whole reason why he exists, right? Mm-hmm. That's why Batman exists, is to kill the guy who
killed
his parents.
Yeah.
And so it's like, the stranger question is like, why is he still Batman?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very good question, Karina, because film is over.
That's why they never kill him anymore. That's why they let them all live.
Well, it's kind of great, because at the very beginning, when he dangles that guy off the top of the roof, and the guy's like, don't kill me, man, don't kill me, man. And Batman then says to the Joker, I'm going to kill you.
So let's talk about what this has wrought.
Oh, yeah, please.
Because it's interesting to me that you started this, Karina, by saying, I'm going to paraphrase you, but essentially you don't watch superhero films anymore. Since Iron Man 3, but can you elaborate on what you think has kind of happened with Hollywood and with your particular taste and where those two things aren't connecting right now for you?
Well, I was never that interested, because I was not a comic book reader. None of these characters meant anything to me, but I would see some of them out of sort of obligation. I genuinely really liked the first Iron Man, because I felt like Downey was really doing something there.
Me too.
It felt like it was sort of the actor taking over the film, like with his sheer force of charisma. And then I just kind of got progressively less interested from movie to movie. I don't care about any of the other characters or any of those performances. And it just started feeling, more rote and more boring to me. And so, yeah, I'm just out. But I guess you could say that, like, since 2013, you know, it's me being out has meant that I'm further and further out of sort of the conversation about the highest grossing movies of the year. You know, that's the last Marvel movie I've seen. I did go see Wonder Woman because people are like, no, this one's different, but it's not different, except it's worse in a lot of ways. And I just feel like I'm not going to get fooled again. Like, every now and then somebody will be like, no, this one's different, but they're not.
Are there blockbuster movies that you do like?
That sure. I mean, when there are blockbusters that are not just these movies, yeah.
I guess I'm asking a different question. Blockbusters, you know, is what a film becomes when it makes a lot of money. But mm-hmm. movies that are kind of designed to be blockbusters.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could give you some recent examples, but it's like, I don't even know what movies are hits anymore. Like, yeah, what would you say those movies are of the past couple of years?
Well, I guess, we're going to do Star Trek soon. Mm-hmm. The 2009 Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams one.
Yeah, I saw the first one. I fell asleep in the theater during the second one, and now I'm out.
Sure. Did you like the first one, out of curiosity?
I liked Chris Pine in it. Like, I thought, This guy's a movie star.
Right.
But otherwise, I could sort of take it or leave it.
So I guess question that Kenny's circling here, and I think it is, you know, these franchises are built in such a way that I wonder whether or not the sort of universality, the attempt of making sure that it's applicable to as many people as possible, is making them kind of vanilla, right? Like, I think that we're losing the special.
Well, certainly. I mean, and again, like, I haven't seen the Joaquin Phoenix Joker. It seems like, you know, maybe that one really was different.
You've seen Taxi Driver, right?
Yes. Yes, and King of Comedy.
Yeah, I think you're good.
I always thought it was more King of Comedy.
Yeah.
Sorry, Greeny, go ahead.
Oh, I think it's definitely, they do all feel safe and kind of the same movie. And again, it's just like, it doesn't feel like people are making these movies because they have a story they want to tell, or like something they want to say about these characters, or that they're using these characters and these stories as a way of saying something about, like, you know, the world we live in, or what human beings are like. They're just doing it to make money. And, you know, maybe there are some exceptions to that, but that feels like that's the trend.
So this is kind of what I think I'm getting at. I think I've put my finger on it finally. You are clearly one of, like, our preeminent film historians. And I've listened to so much of what you've done, and you are not a snob. So it's not that, to me, and I'm trying to, you know, I don't mean to put words in your mouth or make assumptions, so please, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. It's not that you would be out no matter what.
It's, I like, that Mission Impossible movies.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. Like, it's that Hollywood has lost you to some extent. And the problem I see is, what happens to film as a academic endeavor when we are no longer making the kind of films that interest the people who take films seriously? And obviously these films exist, like, in places, but they used to all exist all over the place. Like, as I said, that film, I watched They Shoot Horses, Don't They, this morning, which was made by ABC Films and starring Jane Fonda, and you know, made $16 million 50 years ago, which was only the 16th biggest grossing movie of the year, a year when Midnight Cowboy won Best Picture. Those were the kind of movies that used to get made and
make money.
And make money, and, you know, birth careers and all those things. As an academic and a film historian, what do we do? Like what's happening, and what do you see? And it's not even like
no, I'm not trying to
just
your point.
Just analyze the moment.
Yeah. Like,
what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I used to go see everything. So I mean, I still would, you know, global pandemic aside. And that's actually the thing that makes it so hard to have a crystal ball in this moment or to diagnose a problem and fix it is like, I don't know if movie going is ever going to come back in the same way. And then I don't know how you respond to how the audience changes. You know, but it really wasn't that long ago that you had, was it 2008 or 2009 when like the Best Picture nominees were like There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Juno, and then I think two other decent movies. Yep. And so now it just feels like we've gotten so far away from that being, those kinds of movies even being made to that extent. And whereas, you know, these kinds of movies existed in 2009. You know, 2009 was also the year of Iron Man, right? I mean, and it's not like Marvel really started anything, because as we've said, like Batman kind of started the trend that like snowballed into Marvel. And in between that, you had the X-Men movies, which is like whatever Batman started. I mean, X-Men like took the baton and ran.
Right after, yeah.
So, you know, I do think these things can coexist. But what worries me is that the pandemic has accelerated the situation where the, you know, it certainly accelerated streaming and this idea that like, you know, we'll just go to where the audience is. And that creates a different kind of content being made. And it creates, it takes away the impetus to make things specifically designed to be seen big with a lot of people. And it changes the economics of everything.
What I think has happened because of all what you said, that I don't know. I'd like to look at it as neutral because it doesn't really matter, but it kind of sucks, is critics aren't really critics anymore. They're advocates. Because if things aren't coming out on a mass scale and available kind of, and I know Netflix democratizes it, but they're hidden, right? Nobody even knows these things, half these things exist. So
until critics, award season.
Until award season,
right?
Because critics have been advocating all
year.
But
then also Netflix actually spends money marketing their movies in December. They don't market their movies before that. And so tons of stuff, they release tons of stuff.
You
don't know about any of it until they're like, well, you know, maybe we can win an Oscar for Power of the Dog.
And these things in general don't even get reviewed because... you know, some of them do. Some movies get reviewed, but for the most part, they don't even get reviewed because they do kind of exist in this, you know, morass of stuff. And that's I don't know. I like the idea of film. I like the idea of cinema as a mass medium. I think that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And the stratification of it has just kind of changed. It's just changed the way we talk about films in a way that leads to less analyzing trends and less of an understanding of filmmaking and techniques and the way things talk to each other and the way things speak to the moment and all those things. And it's more, you know, this movie, Worst Person in the World, is amazing. Watch it when you can. Yeah. You know, which is great. And I'm not knocking Worst Person in the World, but, you know, that's kind of, That's unfortunate that it's just, I have to pick my lanes and my, you know, my one or two movies that I think are important for you to see now.
I mean, there was this moment over the summer, you know, where everybody thought COVID was over because we were vaccinated. It was like 2 weeks. And, it was starting to feel like people that I knew at least were excited about going out again and going to the movies and starting to have like, there started to be this hunger of like having movies to talk about, and there kind of weren't enough yet, you know? And then we're back in our houses for the most part now. But it's,
I think it's
really important to remember like a month before the pandemic at the Oscars that took place in February, 2020, the movies were Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Little Women,
Marriage Story. You know, like these are good movies. They're, you know, they're about something. And Joker was there too. You know, these things can coexist. And they didn't, it wasn't that long ago that they did coexist.
I mean, Kenny and I have had this conversation a lot over the last, you know, year and a half to 2 years in terms of just trying to sort of, you know, guess, I guess, as to how this is all going to play out. I think I'm a little more optimistic than Kenny is about the way that this is all going to play out. No judgment.
Very pessimistic.
But I think that, I don't think that the studios are going to give up necessarily on trying to make the films that you just, you know, listed. I think that, you know, it's going to be a little bumpy for a bit, and I think it's going to take time and patience, and hopefully we'll find a way to get those people back into theaters. You know, this was a weird year. You know, it's disappointing when West Side Story doesn't make any money. It's disappointing when some of these films that are, you know, that you want to see with a big, excited crowd on a big screen, aren't getting the people out to them. But to,
I'm a big Last Duel fan. So, I mean,
Last Duel, I saw that.
Last Duel is a movie that would have made $200 million in 2008, you know?
Yes, correct. Yeah, so it's, but you know, to bring us full loop and to sort of wrap this up on the Batman side of things, I think it's worth saying that, like, a lot of people saw that film in 89 as the beginning of the end. A lot of people that were like, now all people are going to care about is, you know, our big extravagant set pieces and IP and comic books and all these things. And I don't know that it was the beginning of the end, but it was the beginning of something different. And it was the beginning of just a commodification and a level of success that you can't expect studios to turn a blind eye to.
You know, it happens over and over where some studio, some director makes a paradigm shifting movie.
Sure.
And then you have years and years and years of pale imitators that that suck. It happened with Jaws and Star Wars and E.T., Indiana Jones and this film, Pulp Fiction, 100%.
Sure.
You know, up through The Matrix and
yep.
You know, and in the 2000s, we got all the, you know, the YA ripoffs that no one bothered watching that were $200 million movies. So it's a
town of heat-seeking missiles. It always will be. It's always going to look for the thing that pops.
But yeah, it did kind of like signal the beginning of this, not the end of this, of this thing that that we've now been in for about 30 years.
I mean, we are basically
the main difference, and we're not talking about it, but the main difference between this and all the ones that I'd mentioned that came chronologically before it are the tie-ins. So the merchandise and the McDonald's and, you know, the American Express thing was a joke, but it was also product placement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of stuff.
I mean, we're basically at a place now where, I mean, I think it was about a year or two ago, there was rumors that Tim Burton was going to do another Batman movie with Michael Keaton and, you know, that they were going to try to...
We were going to write it, right?
Yeah, Kenny and I were going to write it. But I think that it... I would say that more than anything, it really just comes back to originality. I think that people are still, they still love a good story, something original, and that stuff is always going to be popular in some form or another. But yeah, I mean, IP's IP and that's just what it is. But all that being said, Karina, I'm curious as to how you would rate this film, what you thought of it as a 9-year-old, and what you thought of it today.
So it's really hard for me to remember my sort of critical opinion about it when I was 9.
Sure.
I mean, the movie that I remember better from that summer is Ghostbusters 2.
Sure.
And that was definitely a movie that I've
rewatched
more times. And I mean, talk about product placement, like that I used to go to Sizzler sometimes after camp in the afternoons. And for 2 months before Ghostbusters 2 came out, at my local Sizzler, there was a sign on the door that said, as seen in the soon-to-be-released major movie, Ghostbusters 2. And there is no Sizzler in Ghostbusters 2. There is just a joke about Sizzler.
Yeah, I was gonna I thought you were gonna say you were drinking the Ecto Blaster or whatever.
No, I just think that they sent like a poster to every Sizzler that said soon to be seen in the major motion picture Ghostbusters 2. Anyway, I would have given Ghostbusters 2 a 100 in 1989. Batman, I just honestly can't remember that much of what I thought of it. I mean, I think I was probably a little bit bored and a little bit thrilled. So I'm going to say in 1989, I probably would have given it like a 65.
Okay.
But I think in 2022, let's say I would give it like a 78.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's good. And it's, I think it's really fascinating that it's been almost 30 years since the gap between, and at the same time, the movie hasn't changed that much for you to some degree or another. And I don't mean that in a judgmental way.
I just think that I'm just completely guessing on the 65. So sure, like maybe sure, it's a meaningless sure number, you know, but sure I mean, for me, it's 78, which is pretty high for yeah me, I would say. And it just kind of gets docked because I think like, you know, I didn't know that they hadn't figured out what they were going to do at the top of the cathedral until you said it. But now that explains something to me about how the movie...
Phil, you ruined it.
You know, kind of works it out there. And then I also just think like I this time, you know, was pretty bothered by sort of the weakness of the Vicki Vale character. So, and I think it's important that movies, you don't have to have every movie doesn't have to have like two women having a conversation with each other. Like, I know that's like the minimal standard that we've set. You don't have to have that, but you do have to have a reason for a woman to be in a movie besides for her to have sex with a guy.
Yeah, it feels like a pretty low bar that we, right? Like, I feel like if we could get over the that bar of like, she is only there to have sex with your male protagonist. Yeah, I don't disagree like, with you.
Be at risk of being raped by your villain.
Yeah.
Also so true. Also true.
Yeah. Which was stark in this film. Yes. Every time he kind of pulled her yes away, surrounded by, you yes know, gun-toting bad guys, mm-hmm. I mean, I thought about my kid, and I'm like, what does he think that Joker wants with her? Because well, like,
it's interesting you bring that up because in the scene when they're in her apartment, you know,
that's
the
what
whole,
I'm
the,
thinking of,
right?
Yeah,
and he pulls her, and this is the first time I noticed that Kim Basinger literally almost falls down. Like he's yanking her so hard that you get the impression that she's actually, you know, unbalanced. But anyway, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, great. All right. I'd say in 89, seeing this film, it was probably like a 98. and the reason I want to put it so high is mm-hmm. because I think this is the first film I saw in theaters that I loved. Okay. And that felt like I was the one who was making the decision to love it. It wasn't my parents saying you should love this movie yeah. or my parents putting it on for me or my parents picking the movie we went to. I insisted we see this movie. I begged that we would see this movie and we did. I won mm-hmm. and I loved it. Then before this podcast, I had given yeah. it a 91 uh-huh. Because I still love it and I think it's awesome. But I think it's, and it's interesting because I kind of had the same reaction you had, Karina. You do see seams in this movie. It does feel a little patchworky to me. And I think that was what I was kind of feeling, and you said it. I'm going to go down just a little bit to an 89 for 89, though I still do love this film. But I can't ignore what Karina just said. So it's like, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, it's all true. It's all true. Sure. And it is a fault of the film. And that doesn't make it, you know, any less important or any mm-hmm. less worthy of one's enjoyment.
Like, I'm not about to like write an essay about, you know, what Batman gets wrong about Vicki Vale.
Yeah. It could have been better.
You could, though. I mean, people would read it. I mean, I'll just say this. So when I saw this in 89, I was a big scaredy cat. I really didn't particularly like scary movies. And
you've worked on that though.
I have. Kenny's made me a lot.
Have
a
you
lot.
Seen the new yeah. Scream, by the way, Phil?
Not yet, but you I'm going to see it. Yeah.
Karina, are you a Scream fan?
I was into it in the 90s. Yeah. I don't think I've seen 4. And I haven't seen this new one.
Oh, 4 is actually great. A lot of fun. You might
yeah,
like 4.
4 is great.
But all that being said, I was a big scaredy cat. So I vividly remember being 9 years old and the scene when he electrocutes the guy and like he,
oh,
that
awesome.
Actually, like, it's awesome now. I was 9. I was like, this is not awesome. This is scary. I don't like this.
Yeah.
But ultimately, obviously, still really love the film. I probably would have given it a 90 back in 89. Before this podcast, similar to Kenny, I went up a little bit. It doesn't matter. Anyway, I was at like a 92. I'm at an 89 now as well because I feel as though everything you said is right, Karina. It's hard for me to really ride for a lot of the stuff that's going on in this film. It was a different time, obviously, but still, the Vicki Vale character bumps me. it just feels like they left money on the table and could have just done some really interesting stuff with her. But it's still like, I don't know, watching it the other day, I think we all had the same feeling of just being like, this movie's crazy that it exists and it's cool and weird.
Yeah.
And like, I love that, you know, I guess ultimately I wish the right lessons were taken away from this film. And I feel like the wrong lessons were taken away because of how unbelievably successful it was monetarily rather than creatively. And I wish that, you know, so that's my big takeaway is that I wish that, you know, we aren't where we are now because it made so much money. It would just be nice if, they made cool, weird movies like this more. Anyway, Karina, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Batman with us. We really
thank you. I didn't know this was the last 89 episode you guys are doing, but I'm happy. So happy I got in there.
right at the wire. And I mean, it goes without saying that we'd love to have you back for, you know, future episodes. And we've got lots of exciting movies and things to talk about. And you, as Kenny said, the preeminent film historian.
Yeah. Showing us how it's done
from your padded cell. It's
But
anyway, yes. Thank you so much, Karina. We really do appreciate
it. It's awesome to have you on. Thank you for coming
on.
Thank
you. I'm really happy.
And thank you for all of your podcasts because they've gotten me through runs.
They're the best.
Thank you.
I think that's right, the highest compliment you can give someone. I listen to you while I run and it makes the run better.
I know. I agree. I've definitely listened to your guys' show on a hike.
Thank you. So much for listening, honestly. That means the world to us. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it.
Podcast like it's 1989. Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.